Islam, worship, feminism, pietism, postmodernism. You can meet and hear Issues Etc. regular guests discussing these topics at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Registration is $100 per person. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14 and 15 in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org. Here is the explanation you'll often hear for the decline of religion in the West. Look at Europe and see how many people go to church on Sunday morning. You'll see very, very few. The usual explanation is, well, we've advanced in technology, in learning. We're more enlightened. And with that natural progress of culture comes the natural decline, perhaps even the disappearance eventually, of religion. Is that the real reason for the decline of religion in Western culture? Joining us to talk about that, the decline of both the family and religion in Western culture, Mary Eberstadt. She's senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and she's author of several books, including her latest, How the West Really Lost God, A New Theory of Secularization. Mary, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Oh, thanks for having me, Todd.
What is the conventional wisdom explaining the secularization of the West? How does that story go?
Well, let's just quickly paint a picture of what secularization looks like. Across Europe and into the United States, you see a pattern of declining church attendance. It's far more drastic in Europe than here. But, for example, last week in Great Britain, there was a study that came out that made headline news all over because it showed that within the decade, Christians will be a minority of people in Great Britain. So that's a big deal, and that's what we mean by secularization. Something like 15% of believing Christians in Great Britain go to church once a month at this point. That's not even once a week, once a month. So there is a going explanation for this that's been handed down since the Enlightenment, and most recently you heard it from the New Atheists. And that explanation is, look, you should expect to see religious decline, because religion is a bunch of superstitious beliefs that as people become more educated and more prosperous and more rational, they realize they can do without. That is the conventional storyline, and it's very popular, and I think a lot of people accept it unthinkingly, right? People think they know that more money drives out God or that more education drives out God. Now, the interesting thing about this explanation, Todd, is that it doesn't hold up. And it doesn't hold up for a lot of different reasons, which we can get into if you like. But the purpose of my book is to say, look, what most people think is going on isn't what's going on. Something else is going on to explain religious decline.
So the conventional explanation is essentially this is the natural evolution and progress of society. We will, as we grow wiser and more technologically advanced and more advanced in every way, we will grow less religious. What is your alternate explanation?
Well, let me just say quickly why that one is wrong. First of all, because the United States, for example, although arguably the most materially prosperous country on earth, shows far higher levels of religion, even in the time of secularization, than Western Europe, for example. We also see that within the United States, believe it or not, the top third of the socioeconomic ladder is more likely to profess belief in God and to go to church than the bottom third. And we don't only see that there. I give examples in the book of Victorian England was another situation where it was the better off people who were going to church. So the reason that this is a problem for the conventional storyline, of course, is that if it's education and prosperity that's supposed to drive out God, that's not what the patterns actually show. So we can put that one behind us. The long story short is that when you study the historical timeline, what you see is not the inevitable decline predicted by secular thinkers. You see something much more interesting. Christianity comes and goes in the world, and when it is strong, the family is strong. When it is weak, the family is weak. And in my book, I call this phenomenon the double helix of family and faith, where each side needs the other side to effectively reproduce itself. This is not how conventional sociology has seen this relationship. In conventional sociology, The family is very little discussed, and it's mainly a kind of afterthought. Sometimes sociologists who study religion will say, well, first there's religious decline, and then that has certain effects on family size and family life and so on. I think the relationship there is much more interdependent, and I think that examples from history verify this. So that is the new idea that I'm trying to get at with the book.
So you're not necessarily trying to answer the chicken and egg question here with regard to family and faith, but you're saying there is an undeniable correlation between the two historically, and that's a better explanation, this interdependency, than the inevitable progress of society.
Well, I think you can show that there are certain ways in which, for example, family decline on the level that we experience it today does get in the way of people going to church. One example that I give is that if you think about the Christian story, this is a story that is saturated with familial metaphors and ideas about family. It's a story that begins with the miraculous birth of a baby and the Holy Family. The problem with this is that they don't have immediate experience of those things. So, for example, in an era when many millions of kids are growing up in fatherless households, the idea of God as a benevolent, loving father figure might be just a little bit harder to grasp than it is to kids who are growing up in a home with a loving dad. That's one example. Similarly, in a time of declining families and smaller families and steeply reduced birth rates, there are many people who grow to adulthood who've never even held a baby, who won't have children of their own, who may not understand for those reasons exactly what is so incredible about the story of the birth of Jesus. So I'm not saying that people from those homes can't grow up to be religious. What I'm saying is there are things about family decline that put extra barriers in the way of understanding Christianity. And, of course, where we see this most clearly is in the cases where many people are living in violation of the traditional Christian moral code and do not want to be reminded that a code exists that says, hey, you know, what you're doing isn't really approved by the good book. So that's a whole other area where we see new resistance to Christian religious belief. There was always, of course, because the world is full of sinners, there was always a tendency for people to fall short of this very difficult moral code. But what we see now is a kind of belligerence about it, where enough people are living in public defiance of it that they don't want to hear about it anymore, and they want to marginalize Christians as extremists. So that's another factor that's helping to keep some people out of church, I think.
What we're finding there, then, is something that would you say that exacerbation, that kind of hostility toward those unpleasant reminders in a Christian worldview in the culture for people who are living outside those parameters, is that new to us today? I mean, I'm thinking about no-fault divorce. I'm thinking about the, at least in America, the unprecedented out-of-wedlock rates, things like that.
Well, it's been developing across the Western world for a while. Again, last year in Great Britain was when the 50% mark was passed on illegitimate births or out-of-wedlock births. So it's been a cumulative sort of thing. But I think it has reached a kind of critical mass where Christians are now feeling on the defensive about these things for the most part. And their detractors are now feeling emboldened in ways that they weren't before to try and marginalize traditional Christianity in the public square. And I think we've been seeing quite a lot of that, again, starting with the rhetoric of the new atheist, but extending beyond it into our own time.
What are some other examples of this interconnectedness between family and faith and culture?
I think one very powerful example comes from the post-war era. After World War II and continuing into the early 1960s, there was a religious revival across the Western world. Church attendance was up in Germany, in Great Britain, Denmark, Spain, France, the United States. It was remarkably up. And this revival didn't just come out of nowhere. It was accompanied by a much more familiar revival, which was the baby boom. There was a marriage boom followed by a baby boom, and then we saw this incredible religious boom that was so powerful in the United States that it even affected the popular culture. There were all of these pro-religious Hollywood movies made that would be kind of unthinkable today. But that's an example of the phenomenon that in the book I call family drives people to church. There is something about having families that, and more than one something, I think, that makes it more likely that people will, with families will end up in church. We know statistically that this is true. We know that just getting married and having a baby makes it significantly more likely that you will go to church. But what I try to do in the book is unpack some of the reasons why it might be true, because I think they're really interesting and they've been overlooked by conventional sociology.
What are some of those reasons why family drives church attendance?
Well, it's funny. I was talking to a pastor recently who said almost all of his new recruits are people who show up in church with a baby in their arm. But there is something about having a baby that makes people feel like they should go to church. So let's talk about some of those things. I mean, for one thing, just having a baby is experienced by many people as a religious or cosmic phenomenon. It's something transcendental. It makes you think about your connection to the generations behind you and the generations to come. Many people translate that into a religious feeling and feel motivated to connect with some religious institution like a church. So that's one reason. On a more pragmatic level, many people, and this is what the pastor was saying to me, feel like they want their child situated in the kind of religious upbringing they had. They want some kind of assistance bringing up the child. They want to seek out a religious community where there are like-minded people who can help instill the things in the child that they want to instill. So those are two kinds of examples of how just having a family or living in a family helps to drive people to church.
Mary Eberstadt is our guest. We're talking about the decline of the family and religion in Western culture. When we come back, the role of fertility. Stay tuned.
There's no question that the kids have been completely lost in the shuffle during this whole 40-year war.
Suzanne Venker, author of The Flip Side of Feminism, on the impact of feminism on children.
There's no discussion of what children's needs are. You're not even allowed to discuss children's needs because, of course, the engine of the feminist movement is dependent on abortion and daycare. Those are the two things that remove children or babies from the equation so that we can achieve this faux version of equality. And without those two things, they have no movement. So there is no acknowledgement of what children's rights and or needs are in this discussion. It is solely about adult needs.
You can hear and meet Suzanne Venker, Making the Secular Case Against Feminism, at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org.
Talk radio for the Christian worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the decline of family and religion in Western culture. Mary Eberstadt is our guest. She's authored the new book, How the West Really Lost God, A New Theory of Secularization. In about a half hour or so, we're going to be talking with Pastor Tom Baker, teaching a Sunday school lesson on Genesis chapter 11, the famous story of the Tower of Babel. Mary, let's talk a little bit about the role of fertility or infertility, lack of fertility in all of this. Many people assume that devout Catholic families are larger because of the Church of Rome's prohibition against some forms of birth control. But you say that doesn't explain why devout Catholic families are larger.
Yeah, this is a really interesting phenomenon. And I cite several demographers who study these numbers, and they all reach the same conclusion. The more religious you are, the more likely you are to have a large family. Now, up until now, when sociology looks at that fact, it says, well, of course, that's just something religious people do. Religious people just have large families. I say that's not an explanation. It seems more logical to suppose that there is something about living in a large family that is helping to drive people to church. There is something about living in a large family that is making people more religious, because this is practically an iron law of demography. We see it across the world, not only with Christians, but with religious, Muslims, Jews. Everywhere you look, people are more likely to have large families the more religious they are. And conversely, secular people have few children or none at all. And so what I'm trying to do, again, is kind of get at the heart of that relationship, what's really going on there, because it's not enough to say, well, it's just that they're religious, therefore they have more children.
Does the age of marriage, the age for marriage, have anything to do with this? Is there any correlation between early or late marriage in the data?
That is not something that I've studied. I know there are arguments out there, particularly by Mark Regnerus, making the case for early marriage based on the fact that when people marry younger, they have children younger and spend more time in a church community, again, because there are things about having babies that drive people to church. But more specific than that, I can't get.
You write about fundamental changes in family formation and its connection to the decline of Christianity in the West. What are you talking about when you talk about family formation?
Well, again, I'm talking about what happens when you have some critical mass of households that don't have a dad in them. How can you get across the idea that God is some kind of loving father to people who don't know what a loving father is like? That's, I think, an especially potent example of how the ways that families have changed have put new impediments in the way to religion, but specifically to Christianity, because Christianity is so suffused with the idea of the family, and it depends in part on people grasping what family relationships are like.
Is it that without the experience of, say, a father, or with the experience of some sort of alternate way of family formation, the vocabulary, if you will, for lack of a better word, simply doesn't exist for many people that is so part and parcel, so woven into the narrative of Christianity?
Yes, I think it is like that. It is like a language problem. It's that people in the fractured family world have to, in effect, make up another translation for themselves of what's going on out there. Or, as I put it in the book at one point, there are things about family illiteracy that breed religious illiteracy, which is a new way of looking at the relationship between those things, but I think it's one that really holds up.
Let's talk a little bit about, a couple factors. I wanted to include divorce and abortion, but what about divorce? What does your alternative explanation for secularization in the West, how does it include the factors bearing upon divorce?
Well, you know, the conventional explanation, again, is just that people sort of sat in a corner one by one and changed their minds about God, and then they were free from the Judeo-Christian moral code, and so you saw a rise in divorce. I'm not sure that that holds up. I think what does hold up is the idea that Christianity frowns on divorce and frowns on a lot of other things. It's a very tough moral code, as the disciples were the first to complain. But it is what it is. And when you live in a world after the sexual revolution, when a lot of people not only want to defy that code, but suddenly have the technological means to defy it, and to look as if they can have sex without the usual consequences, then you have a world in which a lot of people have a vested interest in either rewriting Christianity or repudiating the traditional moral code.
What about legalized abortion?
Well, abortion has been frowned upon in Christianity and Judaism as far back as you go, and this has been a pretty united teaching. So obviously there again, the fact that we live in a world where so many people have had abortion, which is regarded as a grave sin in traditional Christianity and even in parts of non-traditional Christianity, there again we have a reason why some people would have new psychological reasons to resist Christianity or to say, well, it can't be right about that, or otherwise to distance themselves from this thing. And, you know, abortion on the scale that we have it today did not exist before. So we have lots of people with reasons like that.
So it goes, as you just said, it goes to two factors. One, it changes how the family is formed, radically changes how the family is formed, and in many cases, if we're quite honest, how the family is destroyed through legalized abortion. But it also plays into that avoidance factor you mentioned before, that families that have been formed by abortion, shaped by abortion, are less likely to want to hear anything that Christianity might say about it.
Yes. Yeah, sure, Todd. And also there again, we see that abortion gets in the way of understanding what is sacred about the birth of Jesus, you know, in a very subtle way. Anyone who's lived after Roe v. Wade has lived in a world where birth is regarded as negotiable. Every single birth is regarded as negotiable. If you are here, it's because somebody wanted you here. So this is a very different psychological mindset from, say, in the Bible, when Mary is told that Jesus is coming, and she says, I wholeheartedly accept whatever it is that is your will. That kind of obedience about birth to generations who have seen so many discarded births is, again, something that is a little bit harder to get across or to understand. So here we have another example of the way in which the world after the sexual revolution has put new barriers in between at least some people and Christian belief. And that is part of what's driving the decline of the churches. The decline of the churches is not coming about for the reasons that the new atheists say it's coming about. It's not because people are sitting in a corner and worrying themselves to death about the problem of evil or, you know, Galileo or various fine points of scriptural interpretation. It's not that cerebral an exercise. I think what's going on is that the sexual revolution put tremendous pressure on the family, fracturing the family across the Western world in many cases, and that fallout is what is getting in the way of religiosity for some people, not sitting around and trying to think of theological fine points they have problems with.
What would you say to the secularist who says, look, okay, I don't care how you explain it, it's headed in the right direction, and why should I care about, say, America moving the direction of Europe when it comes to the religious demographics, or Europe going even farther than it already has when it comes to the religious demographics? Why should I care, asks the secularist. What's your response?
Sure. Well, a couple of responses to that. One is just pragmatic. If you look at what religious believers give back to Western society, it's very interesting, and it's certainly a net plus. Let's talk for just a second about private charity, for example. It's been well documented by social science that religious believers are more likely to give money to charitable causes, to volunteer their time for things, even to give more blood than secular people do. It looks like there's actually a connection between having a creed that tells you to take care of sick people and poor people and actually trying to do some of that. So what religious believers do in the public square in that way benefits everybody. And conversely, if you take a society like France, it's very secular, where I think some of our more aggressive secularists would like to see us go, there's very little charitable giving in France. because secular societies don't give money to private causes. So that's one reason why I think it's a little short-sighted of people who have gone from being a Christian, you know, non-Christian to anti-Christian. I think it's a little short-sighted of them to do that. But also, another response I would make to somebody like that is, look, if you study the timeline, you know, you realize that there's nothing inevitable going on out there. The last revival, the revival we talked about earlier involving the baby boom and the religious boom of the 1950s, was not foreseen by demographers and economists. And other moments of Christian revival in history also haven't been foreseen. So I don't think, if I were a secularist, that I would be complacent about, well, if I just wait them out, you know, we'll get to where Sweden is today. Because history is full of too many surprises for that.
We're talking about the decline of family and religion in Western culture. Mary Eberstadt is our guest, senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., author of several books, including her latest, How the West Really Lost God, A New Theory of Secularization. When we come back, another 10 minutes with her. The latest Issues Etc. journal is out. I've written an article there answering the question, does God have other ways of salvation that we don't know about other than Jesus? The article is called What God Cannot Do. Also in the Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor John Fraser talks about his journey from, I guess, beginning with Baptist decision theology and through Reformed theology to the Lutheran Reformation. You can read all about it and look at a good list of the Issues Etc. 300 congregations at the end of the latest Issues Etc. journal. You can subscribe for free at our website, issuesetc.org. There's a big red button on every page. Click on that, enter your email address, and we will send you the latest Issues Etc. journal. You can also read back issues of the journal at our website, issuesetc.org. Click publications. When we come back, I wonder if Mary's as concerned about the radical privatization of religion as well as secularization. Stay tuned.
That's me in the spotlight, losing my religion, trying to keep
where Christianity meets culture. You're listening to Issues Etc.
South Africa,
China,
Germany,
Trinidad and Tobago.
Did you know that people listen to Issues Etc. around the world?
India,
Sweden,
Egypt, France,
Turkey, Japan,
Australia, Canada,
United Kingdom,
Hong Kong,
Austria,
Finland, Malaysia,
Singapore, Bulgaria,
Korea, Brazil.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Help us proclaim Christ to the world.
The Philippines,
Mexico,
Spain,
New Zealand,
Kuwait.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Tuesday afternoon, May the 28th. We're talking with Mary Eberstadt, author of How the West Really Lost God, A New Theory of Secularization, about the decline of the family and religion together in Western culture. In about 10 minutes, Pastor Tom Baker will join us. He's going to round off this hour of Issues Etc., teaching a Sunday school lesson on the Tower of Babel in Genesis chapter 11. Mary Eberstadt, a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Mary, we've talked a lot about secularization generally. Are you as concerned about what some have called radical privatization of religion, things like redefining religious freedom very narrowly as freedom of worship and very little more, etc.?
Well, of course, because this distinction that is being forced on the public by mostly by partisans of the Obama administration does not hold up under scrutiny. If they're going to be consistent, then they ought to go tell people, don't give money to orphans around the world because of your Christian conscience. That's a public act that's having a public effect. So it seems to me instead something much more cynical is going on, which is that they're perfectly happy when they can benefit from it to have religious believers do what they do in public, And then the second, that the religious believers are doing something they don't like in public, they want to kind of arbitrarily pull the rug out from under them. But this is not a policy based on principle, so I don't think it's a policy that's going to hold up.
Can the American ethos, and we're talking here kind of broadly about the basic ideas and the implementation of those ideas in law and in culture that we call America, can that be sustained if America itself is increasingly secularized and, as you've pointed out so well, if along with it, the family is in decline?
Family decline is a problem for that reason. It extends beyond religious matters, actually. If you look at what's been happening across the West for the last several decades, and I get into this in the book because it's obviously part of the picture, what you see is that family decline has been bankrolled by the welfare state. You know, in the case of the Obama administration reelection campaign, we had this video. Do you remember the Julia video, Todd, that showed the welfare state taking care of a certain individual from cradle to grave, you know, from daycare on up through various benefits programs? Now, this is the promise the welfare state has made, and the welfare state has had to keep it because we have so much family fracture. You could also argue we would have a lot less family fracture if the welfare state weren't there, which I think is obviously true. But the point is, there's something else going on, which is simple economics. Demographics has changed. There aren't enough younger taxpayers to support these vast welfare states of the West. Certainly, the number of taxpayers 10, 20 years out is far lower than the designers of these modern welfare states thought there would be. So this is a long-term problem that may end up creating a financial crisis all its own. In fact, people much more knowledgeable than I often say that it will, because we don't have the taxpayer base to sustain this. Now, if that happens, if the welfare state has to be reined in, then it will be obvious that we don't have non-family units to fall back on the way we thought we did. And I think that will encourage a rethinking of the modern fractured family, which, after all, is a pretty new experiment when it comes to, you know, the sweep of history. And I think seeing the toll of that, not just the toll of broken homes and that, you know, the stuff that is more commonly talked about, but rather the economic and financial toll of this perhaps unsustainable experiment is going to affect the way people think about the family, and could even end up encouraging a family revival.
Nature abhors a vacuum. Does the decline of the family, in the vein of what you were just saying there, does it make, in some sense, inevitable the replacement of the family, to one degree or another, with the state?
If the state can afford it. I think that's the it's not a $1 million question. It's a number higher than I can count to or name. That question is hanging over the societies of the Western world, not only the United States. And I think the way it is decided is also going to affect how people see the families of the future, how much more inclined or less inclined they might be to form them, and so on. I think the welfare state has a tremendous effect on the fractured family and vice versa.
What if the state can't afford it? What does it look like then?
Well, in times of adversity, what do people do? They usually go home. They go back to their more organic connections. They go where they know they can trust things. We've seen this on a much smaller scale following 2008 and the financial crisis then. A couple of interesting things happened. One, there was a fall in the divorce rate, which divorce lawyers attributed to the reluctance of people to make that radical and expensive move at a time of financial difficulty. Two, we also saw this interesting phenomenon called the boomerang generation, where a lot of college-aged kids, especially, instead of striking out on their own, ended up at home with their parents. Now, typically, this has been described as a negative thing, but I think you can also reinterpret those kinds of developments as examples of how adversity drives people home. Adversity drives people back to their families. So to answer the question about the welfare state, if the state can't afford it, there's only one institution left standing that is likely to take care of you, and that would be the family.
What major lessons should we in the United States learn by looking at what's happening in Europe now about family and faith?
Well, the first lesson, the biggest lesson, I think, is that what you have been told is wrong. The main storyline for the disappearance of Christianity actually is incorrect when judged by the social science we now have. It is not that people get richer and stop going to church. It is not that people get smarter and stop going to church. There's something else going on when they stop going to church. So that, in a way, is a liberating thought, because I think even believers have unconsciously imbibed this idea that they're somehow on the wrong side of history in all this. So the first thing to understand is that the Enlightenment secular view of all this is wrong. I think also we need to understand how much the families affect the churches. And that's why I devote a lot of attention to that in the book. Strong churches today are made up of strong families. And we see this, for example, let's talk about the Anglican Communion. You know, the Church of England took the approach some time back that it wanted to be a kinder, gentler kind of Christianity. It softened the traditional moral code. It made a point of reaching out. It reached out so much that now there's a huge fight within the ranks of the Anglican Communion about, you know, whether to be traditionalist in certain matters or whether to go along with the Church of England. Well, the Church of England, the kinder, gentler church, has been selling off real estate left and right. There are churches all around Britain that have been turned into guest houses and spas and mosques, and they're losing members by the week. Now, on the other hand, the churches of the Global South, those are the churches in Africa of the Anglican Communion, that have taken a tougher approach to the Christian moral code and said, no, we're not going to loosen up the way the Church of England did. Those are the churches with standing room only. So one important thing to understand if you are a believer is that it is the stronger churches that do well over time, because if you water things down so much that you're just telling people to be nice, a lot of them will conclude that they can be nice on their own and not show up for church on Sunday. So that's one of the sort of basic readouts of this kind of research.
Are you, in the end, a pessimist? Do you believe, to reference Europe again, do you believe that Europe is inevitably the shape of things to come for the West?
No, I don't believe in that word, inevitable, as applied to human affairs. I think history has a way of making us humble about using a word like that. In the book, I give people a choice. I give one chapter on the case for pessimism and one chapter on the case for optimism. And I really do think I was as even-handed as I could be, and I would like them to make up their own minds about it. In my particular case, I think I lean toward a kind of tough-minded optimism, in part because I'm a contrarian, and I think there's so much pessimism out there that we have to remind ourselves of the reasons why inevitable doesn't describe any social movement, including what we see going on in the families and the churches.
Mary Eberstadt is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and she's author of several books, including her latest, How the West Really Lost God, A New Theory of Secularization. And you can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Mary, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, Todd, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
When we come back on this Tuesday afternoon, on the 28th of May, we're going to be spending some time with Pastor Tom Baker teaching a Sunday school lesson. Coming off of Pentecost, you are hearing the echoes of that Old Testament story, the Tower of Babel. Maybe your preacher talked about it. It's right there in the 11th chapter of the book of Genesis, and the words that introduce it actually come back in the 9th chapter of the book of Genesis. The sons of Noah that went forth from the ark, Shem, Ham, Japheth, we kind of know those names. These three people were the sons of Noah, says the author of the book of Genesis. And from these people, the whole earth was populated, but not until God performs an act of, well, it's both mercy and judgment, the Tower of Babel. What is the great sin that these people have committed that God would come down and confuse their languages? Pastor Tom Baker will be our guest when we come back, teaching a Sunday school lesson with him in Genesis chapter 11.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Does your church need a backup organist? The Virtual Organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the logo for the Issues Etc. Journal and Weekly Bulletin insert at issuesetc.org and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. Issuesetc.org, look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo, and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.